Chapter 27. Theodore Roosevelt said that the right of popular government is incomplete unless it includes the right of voters not merely to choose between candidates when they have been nominated, but also the right to determine who these candidates shall be. Three major methods have been used by the parties in American political history to name candidates: the caucus, the convention, and the direct primary. The caucus was discarded early because it gave the legislature undue influence over the executive. The convention method for choosing presidential candidates was first used in 1831 by the anti-Masonic party, but the basic flaw in any convention system is the method of choice of delegates to the convention. The origin of the direct primary is somewhat obscure, but it is generally considered as having been adopted by the Democratic Party in Crawford County, Pennsylvania, in 1842. However, not until Robert M. La Follette became governor of Wisconsin early in 1900 was a political leader successful in pushing through a mandatory statewide direct primary system. Because no public regulation exists to control it, the National Convention has developed into one of the most remarkable political institutions in the world. In no other nation on this planet is the selection of national leaders, whose influence is to be felt profoundly throughout the world, and the formulation of ostensibly serious policies placed in the hands of a convention of about 3,000 howling, only cursorily consulted delegates and alternates. Monsieur Ostrogorsky, a French observer of the American political scene, wrote in 1902 of the convention system, "You realize what a colossal travesty of popular institutions you have just been witnessing. A greedy crowd of office holders, or of office seekers, disguised as delegates of the people on the pretense of holding the grand council of the party, indulged in, or were victims of, intrigues and maneuvers, the object of which was the chief magistracy of the greatest republic of two hemispheres, the succession to the Washingtons and the Jeffersons. Yet when you carry your thoughts back from the scene which you have just witnessed, and review the line of presidents, you find that if they have not all been great men, far from it, they were all honorable men. And you cannot help repeating the American saying, 'God takes care of drunkards, little children, and of the United States.'" The climate of welcome in which the convention of 1960 opened was like many of those that had preceded it. Hotels were festooned with bunting. Distillers had provided all saloons with printed partisan displays, the backs of which carried the same message in the name of the other party, whose convention would follow in 3 weeks. The midtown streets were choked with big-hipped broads wearing paper cowboy hats. Witty legionnaires rode horses into hotel lobbies. Witty legionnaires squirted friendly streams from water pistols at the more defenseless-looking passers-by. Gay delegates hung $20 call girls by their heels out of high hotel windows. Ward healers issued statements on party unity. Elder statesmen were ignored or used, depending on the need. The pickpocket squad worked like contestants in a newsreel husking bee. 104 men's suits were misplaced by the dry-cleaning services of 38 hotels. Petitions and documentations were submitted to the Resolutions Committee by farm lobbies, labor unions, women's organizations, temperance groups, veterans blocs, anti-vivisection societies, and national manufacturers' turnverines. 2,104 hand towels, over the minimum daily quota, would be used on an average for each night the convention sat in the city. A delegate was arrested, but not prosecuted, for wrestling with a live crocodile in Duffy Square to call attention to the courage of a Florida candidate for the vice presidency. The world's largest campaign button was worn by a bevy of lovely young apple farmers from the Pacific Northwest. Although their candidate came from Missouri, he happened to be in the apple business. At 8 a.m., 2 hours before the convention opened on Monday morning, Marco conducted a drill of 200 FBI and Army intelligence agents and 310 plainclothes men and women of the New York Police Department assembled in the backstage area of the garden where they were briefed on the overall assignment. Marco was so frantic with worry and fear that his hand shook as he used the chalk on the large blackboard on a high platform. After Marco's briefing, more and more detailed briefings were conducted down through the units of command to squad level, until Marco, Amjack, Lehner, and the chief inspector of the New York police were sure that each man knew what he was to do. The 27th National Convention of the party was opened by Miss Viola Narvilli of the great Indianapolis Opera Company, singing the national anthem. This one, as her manager explained, was a bitch of a song to sing, as any singer, professional or otherwise, would tell you, and, he said hotly, I'd like to have lifted Miss Narvilli out of her own body by her vocal cords to get up to those unnatural notes which some idiot thought he was doing great when he wrote it. Miss Narvilli's manager tried to throw a punch at the national chairman. He had practically begged them to open the convention, singing the lousy song. Then not one single television shot had been taken of Miss Narvilli from beginning to end, before or after. And they had spent their own loot to come all the way in from a concert in Chicago. After the national chairman got some help from two sergeants-at-arms in shaking Miss Narvilli's manager loose, he called the first session to order. Nearly 600 of the 3,000 delegates settled down to listen to the welcoming speech by the party's senator from New York. The chairman made his formal address following this token welcome, and the hall filled up just a little more, and the business of permanent organization, credentials, rules and order of business, platform and resolutions got underway, and filled the time nicely until the keynote speaker took over in the TV slot that had been bought on all networks for 9 to 9:30 that evening. Although Senator Eisleman and his wife did not attend the first day's session, an Eisleman headquarters had been established on a full floor of the largest West Side hotel near the garden. Also, the Loyal American Underground had established recruiting booths for Johnny in the lobbies of every official convention hotel, and had rented a store opposite the 8th Avenue entrance to the garden. The store had been an upholstery store before the convention, and would be an upholstery store again. One enthusiastic newspaper reported that these recruitment booths had registered 4,200 members. Mrs. Eisleman had thought it prudent to register the same 100 people again and again throughout the days to ensure the excitement of action at all booths. But the exact number of new recruits could not be determined accurately. On the opening Monday, true to his word as an officer and a gentleman, General Francis Fightin' Frank Bollinger headed a parade made up of state and county chairmen of 10 million Americans mobilizing for tomorrow, down 8th Avenue from Columbus Circle to the Garden. They were 246 strong from the 49 states, plus an irregular battalion made up of loyal wives and daughters, various uncommitted New Yorkers who enjoyed parading, and a police squad car. They marched the 9 short blocks with Fightin' Frank holding in one gloved hand the front end of a continuous paper petition that stretched out behind him for 8.5 blocks and contained at least 4,000 signatures, many of which had been written by the general's own family to fill out the spaces and add to the fun. Many of the newspaper reports got the figure wrong, reporting as many as 1,064,219 signatures, although at no time did any representative of any newspaper attempt to make a count. The petition urged the nomination of John Yerkes Eisleman to the presidency of the United States candidacy under the general, indivisive slogan of "The Man Who Saves America." Mrs. Eisleman arrived at Johnny's campaign headquarters at 8 o'clock Monday night. For the next several hours, she received the prospective candidates for the presidency, together with their managers, in separate relays in her suite. At 1:10 a.m., she made the deal she wanted and committed Senator Eisleman's entire delegate support to the candidate of her choice, accepting, on behalf of Senator Eisleman, the assurance of nomination for the office of vice presidency, and losing, for Fightin' Frank Bollinger, the assurance of portfolio as Secretary of State. The party's platform was presented to the convention on Tuesday morning and afternoon, together with many statesmanlike speeches. Professor Hugh Bone, when writing of party platforms as delivered at conventions, said, "If the voter expects to find specific issues and clearly defined party policy in the platform, he will be sorely disappointed. As a guide to the program to be carried out by the victorious party, the platform is also of little value." The British political scholar Lord Bryce observed that the purpose of the American Party platform appears to be neither to define nor to convince, but rather to attract and confuse. The 1960 platform of the party committed itself as follows: 4. Free enterprise, farm prosperity, preservation of small business, reduction in taxes, and rigid economy and government. The latter plank had been axiomatic for both major parties since 1840. Due to the insistence of Senator Eisleman, the platform also demanded the eradication of communists and communist thought without mercy wherever and whenever our flag flies. The roll call for the nomination got underway on Tuesday afternoon, July 12th. Alabama yielded. The nominating speech, the demonstration following that, the seconding speech, and the demonstration following that gave the convention the first aspirant in nomination at 6:21. The identical ritual for the second favorite son took up the attention of the convention to 10:35. The third candidate proposed was nominated on the first ballot by unanimous vote of the convention, as had been 10 candidates of the party since 1900, at 12:41 on July 12, 1960, when the convention was adjourned until noon the following day, when it would meet to deliberate over its choice of candidate for the office of vice president, then await the historic acceptance speeches by both leaders the following night.